Welcome my good friend, Handy Andy Hyde. It's nice to be able to talk to you folks here. This is a unique organization. It's a bunch of people that are dedicated to baseball in their own way. They spend their own time and their own money, and I assume they spend their own money. I don't know where they get it, but they spend their own time and their own money researching things that just for their own personal satisfaction. I don't know of another organization like it in the country.
That's right, Andy. Andy, the Cardinals in 28 dealt for you because they needed a third baseman. In fact, a good friend of ours who just died, Ray Gillespie, was the man who was used as intermediary to coax Rogers Hornsby into dealing for you, Cardinals giving up Les Fell. And you're heading down a stretch, help win that. But you're probably best known for 1930 when the Cardinals, who were 53-52 in mid-August, a dozen games out, went on to win. And the famous game in that heavy hitting season was a series, a 1-0 game in New York, in Brooklyn, and a couple other games. Your explanation of facing Dazzy Vance and your comparison about him, would you tell them about that, please?
Well, I suppose I should tell you one of the stories about how I came to the Cardinals. Ray Gillespie was a writer for the, I think he was with the Star Times, wasn't he, Ray? Yeah. Bob? Ray was about my age and a good friend of mine, and Ray had seen me play with the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Boston Club, and it seems like Les Bell, who had hit 226 for the 1926 Cardinals, and He hit more than Hornsby for the year and was an outstanding hitter. And at the end of the season, Sam Braden decided that he wasn't going to pay Hornsby what he wanted, and he made a deal for Frisch. And Frisch come here, and Bill McKechnie become the manager, and Les Bell didn't have a very good year. And one of the complaints he had was, well, I can't play for anybody but Hornsby. And if you folks didn't know Sam Braden, Sam didn't have a whole lot of patience with a guy that had to have his own private manager to enable him to play good baseball. And Sam got a little upset about it, and he happened to mention it to Ray Gillespie one morning. They were just sitting around talking, And Ray says, well, why don't you trade him? Well, Sam was a good trader. And he says, well, I'd trade him, but I don't know. Who would I get for him? We'd need a third baseman. And Ray says, well, why don't you trade him for Andy Hyde with the Boston Club? And he said, well, I don't know if we went over there and told him we wanted to trade Bell for Hyde. Why, the Boston Club would want too much money for him, or the thing would get messed up. So Ray Gillespie says, why mention Hyde at all? He says, don't mention him at all. You know Hornsby right well. Ray was well acquainted with Hornsby, and he says, you go over and talk to Hornsby and tell him that that Sam Braden and Ricky are mad at Bell because he's not doing so well and he wants to play for Hornsby, and it got Sam teed off. And he says, you go over and tell him Bell's available. And don't tell him who you want, but you just tell him we need a third baseman and we might want some money or something like that, and give him a sort of a vague idea. So Hornsby had been traded to the Boston Club, and Hornsby and I were playing on the same Boston Club. So he was destined to manage the club. It was pretty well known that he would replace the manager who had been named and would eventually manage the Boston club. So Gillespie went over and talked to him and says, "Hey, we can make a deal for the Cardinals are wanting to deal Bell. He's a 226 hitter. In 26, the year they won the World Series from the Yankees, and if you want him, why, you can get him." He says, "Well, what do they want for him?" "Well, they want a third baseman, and they might want a pitcher, and so and so and so." And he says, Hornby says, "Oh, hell, we'll trade him high. We'll send high over there." So they got talking back and forth, and finally Ray talked the Boston club into wanting Bell, and that was the deal that Ray had tried to make all through the deal. So they traded Bell for high, and I had four pretty good years at St. Louis, and it was a good deal.
Andy, how about that 1930 situation with Bazzy Vance? Give him the impression of Vance and Grove, you told me.
Well, we went into Brooklyn in 1930. We were 2.5 games behind the Brooklyn club, and Bazzy Vance is pitching the first game against us. That was a series when Flint Rim went out and got kidnapped and couldn't pitch. There was a few drinks in between. But anyway, he was kidnapped for 3 days, and he didn't show up until the third day, and by that time the Cardinals were on top. But Dazzy Vance opened against Hallahan, and Hallahan was Hallahan. You all know Hallahan's record. He was Wild Bill Hallahan, but a great pitcher when he can get the ball over. And we go into the ninth inning. No, we're going to the tenth inning. We're going to the ninth inning. We're 1-1. In the tenth inning, Gabby Street sends me up to hit for Charlie Gilbert to start off the tenth inning. And Vance was a great pitcher. He had a good fastball. And he had a curveball that just kind of rolled over the table. It was hard to hit. But between the two of them, it was a little easier to hit his curveball than his fastball. And I was sent up to pinch hit, and I wasn't going to let him get a strike on me, so I made up my mind I'd hit the first one, but I couldn't move quite quick enough. He threw it right past me. I says, "Well, he ain't going to throw the next one by me." So he reared back, and he gave me his good Sunday pitch, his fastball. Well, I started at it, but I never made it. And so Dazzy decides, "Well, I'll give him the old Frank Merriwell, three strikes and you're out, for good old Yale." So he says, "I'll throw him my number two." So he throws me his curveball. Well, the curveball don't have the velocity that the fastball has, and he made the mistake of getting the curveball up into the strike zone, and I hit it for two bases. Hallahan bunted me over. We win the game 1-0. And it was quite a thing to hit against Vance. And Vance had me 2-0. I don't know what he'd have done, what I would have done if he'd have thrown me another fastball. But history shows that he didn't. He threw me a curveball, and it was his mistake.
You were telling me one day that you actually, to you at least personally, you regard Vance and Lefty Grove as the toughest pitchers you ever faced. Is that right?
Yes, I would say so. Vance was tough.
Here's one that I think they might be interested in. You backtracking just an instant to 28. You're telling me the problem you had between Bill McKechnie as a manager on the bench and Rabbit Moranville playing shortstop with the Cardinals, were telling you how to play.
Yeah. Well, Some of you folks might be familiar with where the bench is in Old Sportsman's Park. It's about 40 feet from third base. And I'm playing third base, and Rabbit Moranville's playing short. And Rabbit Moranville was a character, and was a great ball player, and he was a fellow that played the game and really enjoyed it all 25 years that he played. He had fun every day he played. And he'd play hunches. And I'm playing third base, and the game plan calls for me to play so-and-so close to the line. Or no, for me to move over towards shortstop. It was a right-handed hitter, and he was not supposed to pull the ball. And that was our game plan. And this specific hitter comes up, and Rabbit's playing short. And Rabbit saw something. He had a hunch, and he figures the guy's going to pull the ball to left field. So Rabbit moves over, and I look around, and Rabbit's right alongside of me. He says, "Get over on the line, get over on the line." And so I move over on the line because Rabbit was, I wasn't a young fellow, but Rabbit was a few years older than me. And when Rabbit got a hunch, why, it was a pretty good thing to play. And I move over, and McKechnie sees me move over, and he's sitting on the bench, and it's not according to the plan at all. And McKechnie says, "Andy, move over, get over, move over." And here Rabbit's hollering, "Move over to the line," and McKechnie's hollering, "Move over towards short, give him the line, give him the line." And I can hear both of them, and I'm kind of between the devil and the deep blue sea. I kind of believe that Rabbit's hunches were right, because he had been correct so often. So I give Bill the deaf ear, and Bill's hollering at me and hollering at me, and he says, finally the inning is over, and I don't recall whether the guy hit the ball. He didn't hit the ball to me, but we come in on the bench, and he says, "What in the hell's the matter with you?" And he says, you're going blind. He says, "You're deaf." He says, "I'm hollering at the bench here in front of you." I says, "Bill, I couldn't hear you." I says, "I was concentrating on the game, and I just couldn't hear you." But I don't think Bill believed me, because he changed his bunt sign shortly after that. And he says, "Well, if I give this guy the bunt sign, I want him to bunt." And Bill used the bunt sign, and he'd holler, and he'd stick his thumb out like that. And if I could see his thumb, I was to bunt. Well, you can't miss a sign like that. That's very, very easy to see. I told Jimmy Wilson, "If this guy gives me a bunt sign in the first inning, bunt, I'm going to miss the sign." And Jimmy says, "Oh, you are." We had a couple of beers, and we were talking, and I was real brave. McKechnie wasn't in the crowd, so I says, "If he gives me the bunt sign, I'm going to miss it." So we're playing in a polo grounds, and Bill comes up in the first inning, and he gives me the bunt sign, and I stepped out of the box as if to tell Bill, "I didn't get it, Bill, give it to me again." Well, Bill's got the bunt sign hanging up there all the time, and he's hollering at me, and I says, "Well, it's going to cost me $50 if I don't bunt, so I better run." I bunted the ball down toward first base, and the man went to second, and before I got to the bench, Jimmy Wilson was out there, and he says, hey, he says, "I was with a guy up in Boston last week, and he told me that he was going to miss the bunt sign if McKechnie gave it to him in the first inning." And I said, "Well, Jimmy, maybe I did say that, but I'd rather do that than cost me $50, so I bunted." And incidentally, Bill McKechnie is one of the real good managers that I played for. And even though I might have tried to mastermind him and say I wouldn't bunt in the first inning, you can't quarrel with success. Bill managed to winning clubs in the American and the National League both, and Bill was one of the good managers that I played for.
Yes,
Speaking of managers, Andy, you were using Stengel as an example, and now McKechnie. You said something about managers that you thought they might be interested in. I think, why don't you take it right from there?
Well, one thing that I'm very candid about and I'm honest about, I used to think that I was a pretty good ball player, and I played ball 12 years in the National League, and I played with three clubs that won World Series, that were in the World Series, and feel like that I was a journeyman ball player. It seems to me that the ball player's idea of who would be a good manager is a debatable point even among the ball players. I thought Jimmy Wilson was going to be the greatest manager that ever managed a ball club. He was intelligent, he was aggressive, he had all the attributes of a big league manager. Well, he didn't quite do that. He managed clubs and didn't have great success. Well, I thought that when Leo DeRocher become manager of the Brooklyn club, I says, gee, we're saddled with a guy here that owes everybody in the United States money, and he's going to be a hell of a guy to play for. I says, well, he just can't manage a club. Well, I was wrong again, because DeRocher was not only a good manager, he was a great manager, and whether you liked him or not, or whether he owed you money or not, he was a good manager. And Leo was a good manager. I've made up my mind that I don't know what are the qualifications of a good manager. I would suggest that at your next meeting, you put on your agenda that you guys write down on a piece of paper, you, assuming that you were the general manager of a big league ball club and you were looking for the ideal manager, what qualifications would you have that manager have? There are many things. Managing a ball club is more difficult today than it was when I came into the league in 1920, in 22 rather. I've been wrong so many times on who's going to be manager. I think that a body like this might be able to give an official decision and draw a picture of the perfect manager.
Andy,
I guarantee you won't come to any conclusion.
Andy, what about that point you were telling me about Stengel over? It was very interesting. I thought your observation.
Well, Stengel, when I went to the big leagues as a coach, Burley Grimes was the manager, and we followed Stengel in there, and Stengel at the time was not considered such a world beater as a manager. He managed the Dodgers 3 years, and they were still the Dodgers. And they remained the Dodgers when Grimes and I were there. So I didn't feel that Stengel was a great manager, but he did manage a great ball club, and he done one great job. He took the Brooklyn native language of the Brooklyn people and parlayed it into quite a career in the big leagues. When he didn't want to tell a newspaper man something, he'd give him some of that flatbush jibber jabber talk, and the guy laughed and he didn't know what he said, and so everyone went home and they were happy. But Casey Stengel had one attribute that I wasn't aware of. At one time, the Yankees got a hold of Irv Norman, an outfielder, a left-handed hitter who had played the outfield for the Brooklyn club and was a good hitter. He was a major league ball player and a good hustler. And Casey got him over there, and most of the guys today, if they're not playing, they raise Cain and they want to be traded, and they're going to get the release, and they're going to do this, and they want to go to this club and that club. But Casey knew how to manage 25 ball players as well as anybody that I've ever known. And Irv Noren was telling me about it. He says, well, I was a utility man on the club, and I was getting kind of teed off. I wasn't playing, and I should have been playing, and this and that. And it's a story that you hear very often in baseball. And he says, we get along for about a month or so, and I'm in a game, the pinch hitting a little bit, and I feel like I'm the fifth wheel on the club. I'm no good to anyone. But we went into Chicago, and he says, say, Irv, he says, you're playing four games here in Chicago. And he says, I want you to stay in shape. He says, you may not play in St. Louis or Pittsburgh, but I want you to be in shape. And Irv Noren commenced thinking about it, and he didn't go in to just relieve the left fielder. He was going to play four games. And it made Noren think that he was of some value to the club. He didn't only do that to Irv Noren, but he done it to every boy on the club. He got a left-handed pitcher from the Cardinals who named Arroyo, a left-handed pitcher. Buddy Blattner might remember him. But he was a junk man. He couldn't... if he dusted you off, he wouldn't even make you mad. But he could get a left-handed hitter out. And Casey took him and used him against left-handed pitchers only. And he told him, he says, now, I want you to pitch to one hitter. And he says, I don't care how many other guys are following me. He says, I want you to get that one guy out. And he put him in against a left-handed pitcher. And he'd leave him in for the rest of the inning. And he would never allow Arroyo to pitch to the same hitter twice. Arroyo, when he got that one hitter out, he'd stay in there until it got his time to bat, and then he was the hit for him. He made Arroyo think he was a good pitcher. He made Noren think he was a good outfielder. He had 25 men on the club that liked the way he managed the club, and I consider that one of his great assets.
Just one more for the moment. Andy, you always say that next to Rogers Hornsby, the greatest right-handed hitter you ever saw, was a great outfielder. A lot of people didn't see here. Strong-armed, lean Chick Hafey, who had such sinus trouble that he wore glasses, was the first man to wear glasses when he won the batting championship. Gene Karsh, sitting over there, was with the Cardinals at the time. Tell us the story about Fresco Thompson and Chick Hafey, and also Hafey and his eyes in the train when he couldn't see very well.
Well, Chick was a big, he's over 6 foot, a strong man, a right-handed hitter, and he pulled practically every ball. If Chick would have tried to go to the other field once in a while, why, he'd have made all three of the outfielders work and would have probably led the league in hitting a couple of times. But Chick hit the ball down third base harder than anybody in the league. And we're playing the Philadelphia Club out in St. Louis. It was one of those hot afternoons. And first time up, Chick belted one down the third base line, and Frisco kind of gave it the how do you do and buy him for two bases. And next time up, he hit another one down that way. And the third time he come up, for some unknown reason, Fresco moved way out to left field. Fresco moved back 10 or 15 feet. And Hafey said, well, I think it'd be pretty smart for me to bunt. So he just bunted the ball, just kind of hit it easily down towards third and walked to first. Fresco Thompson was quite humorous, and he was playing third base for the Philadelphia Club. So when the inning was over, he went out and bought Chick Hafey an ice cream cone and sent it over to the bridge, and he says, that's a present from Fresco Thompson for Button. He says, he just about saved my life if he'd hit another line drive down there. Chick was, in my opinion, one of the great hitters, one of the great right-handed hitters. He was handicapped in that his eyesight was bad. And we were We were sitting on in one of the Pullman cars coming back from some, I forget this where it was at it, but we're sitting all about 3 feet from one end of the car, one end of the Pullman car, and at one end of the Pullman car there'd be a sign, a red background with the name MEN on it, and the other end of the train would be one, other end of the car would be one for women so that people wouldn't get lost, they wouldn't get in the wrong places. So, and we're sitting about 10 feet from this sign that says men. And Chick says, you know, my eyes have been bothering me the last few days. He says, I can see there's a sign down there. I says, I can put my hand over this eye, and I can see that it says men up there. And he said, I put my hand over the other eye, and he says, I can't see nothing but a big blur. And here's a guy that's only got, he's got, I don't know what the eye doctor would say, 20/20 is perfect, but he couldn't see out of one eye at all. And Chick was hitting about 360, and he was hitting home runs and doubles, and I had two good eyes and two good legs, and I was willing and able, and yeah, I was still hitting my 290 or whatever it was supposed to be hitting. But this guy was hitting 70 points more than me, and he was hitting home runs. He would have been one of the greatest hitters if he'd had two good eyes. If he'd been blessed with two good eyes, he would have been as good a hitter as Hornsby, whom I think was the greatest hitter that ever lived.
Thanks very much, Andy. Thank you.